This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
As we did with the payroll increase in January and cutting the spending they give to their people, such as the Social Security cuts announced today. It is tragic. It is economically counterproductive. It represents a betrayal of the needs and desires of the American people who poured their money, their wages, into this Social Security fund over the years, a fund that was and remains way in the surplus, so there's no justification in terms of the funding of the Social Security system. But the worst thing of all about this is that moving to a chained calculation of the cost of living increase, which is what this is technically called, by giving less money to seniors, what this does is it makes the older people, after a lifetime of work contributing to the American economy, it makes those elderly who had no responsibility for bringing this crisis, who got none of the generous bailouts given to the big banks and corporations, it is now confronting them with paying the costs of a crisis they did not bring and of the bailouts they did not participate in. It is unjust, unfair, and the only reasonable response to the economics of what this government is doing in this compromise between Obama and the Congress, between Republicans and Democrats. The only legitimate response is shame on you.
Now, the Republicans still say, even in spite of this giveaway by Obama, that they're not going to fold when it comes to essentially a really expanded tax on the rich. Does that surprise you? On the one hand, the Republicans are holding strong and Obama seems to be caving?
No, it seems to me that the Republicans have had a consistent strategy of making Obama cave in on more and more of the things that he might have wanted and some of the things he promised. I would remind everyone that not only Obama, but that Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate, went out of their way to talk about saving the middle class, protecting the middle class, serving the middle class throughout the election campaign that we had to endure for so many months before November. Cutting the Social Security payments is a direct assault on middle and lower income Americans who are the ones who depend in a significant way on what Social Security pays. It is therefore a direct betrayal by both parties of what they claimed to want to champion, namely the needs of the middle class. And the same is true of raising the payroll tax. Let's be real clear. On the 1st of January 2013, the payroll tax, which is the way we fund Social Security, was increased from 4.2% to 6.2% for the year 2013. So everybody in America, 150 million people who get a weekly check where there's withholding of the payroll tax, they all are now pouring more money into Social Security. That is the same Social Security system that just announced it's going to give people less while it taxes them more. That's austerity. That's causing the mass of people to bear the burden of a crisis and of the bailouts on top of the 6 years of unemployment, home foreclosure they've already suffered. And the Republicans sit there and have a wonderful time. They hobble the president, making it less and less possible for him to do the kinds of things that might conceivably get us out of this crisis, and then they turn around and denounce him for having failed to get us out of the crisis. It seems to be the 1-2 punch that, in their judgment, will get them back in the White House where they can proceed to do the same thing with perhaps a touch more gusto.
There was a recent announcement. Everybody in the sort of corporate business community who was interviewed on mainstream and corporate media were shocked and surprised at the lack of new jobs created last month. I guess, how would you respond to that? Were you surprised? What might that indicate?
No, I was not surprised. And the logic here is pretty straightforward economics. If you remember what we just said, payroll taxes went up, by a whopping 45%, from 4.2 to 6.2. For every $50,000 earned by an American family, that meant $1,000 more out of that income taken by the government beyond what it took last year. What that means is that average American families have thousands of dollars less to spend. That's fewer goods and services that they can afford to buy, and that means fewer jobs for Americans producing those goods and services, and therefore unemployment will trend up. If on top of that you add the so-called sequester that began March 1st with across-the-board government cutbacks in spending, and before you even get to the cutbacks in Social Security announced today, that's very crucial. The government is the largest buyer of goods and services in the United States country. So the federal government announcing the sequester means that the largest buyer of goods and services is announcing that the buyer will buy fewer goods and services. Well, we already know that the people can't buy but fewer goods and services because of the payroll tax increase. Now the government is cutting back on goods and services. That can only mean fewer jobs for people producing the goods and services that can't be bought. The cost of an austerity program of the sort being pursued by this government and the Republicans is to worsen the economic conditions and to worsen unemployment. We've seen exactly that across Europe since 2010, and we are now lockstep following down that path, so that no one should be surprised that the March numbers already show what the April numbers will also show, which is a slowing down in our unemployment improvement situation. Final point. Before the crisis hit, throughout the year 2007, the last year we had before a crisis, the unemployment rate in the United States was about 4.8%. It reached a high of 10% in 2009. It is now 7.8%. That means it isn't even halfway back to the unbearable level of 4.8%, which is very high, that we had before the crisis. There is no recovery in terms of the life situation, work situation of American people. And this austerity program, with its latest installment of Social Security cuts, will make that situation worse.
Who will suffer now based on these latest cuts and the austerity that you've been describing? How can we see this in real terms?
Well, there's a couple of ways. First of all, if you cut, whatever you call it, whatever the mechanism, if you cut the payouts to older folks on Social Security, you create new tensions and problems, financial problems, for the elderly. But of course, if you know how, let's be honest, stingy the Social Security system is, how it is in fact a supplement for most elderly people. They couldn't possibly live on it. It's too small. It means, in effect, what all older people in America, the tens of millions of them that we have, what they're going to be forced to do by these Social Security cutbacks is to lean more heavily on their children, who are already required to help them, who are having a hard time putting their own children through college. They are now going to have growing demands to help out their elderly parents. The financial tensions, the intra-family tensions, I'm always struck that the proponents of cutting Social Security are usually the same politicians celebrating family values. Well, what you've just done by squeezing the elderly is put unbearable additional tensions on already stressed families. So I will see that and expect to see that show up in a host of tragic statistics about family squabbles, family breakups, divorces, intrafamily abuse, and all the rest of it. But in addition, the basic costs of unemployment will now rise with the rising unemployment because of this absurd and unjust austerity program. And that means as more people lose their jobs, they will be unable to meet their mortgage payments. So whatever little bit of improvement we've had in the housing market is threatened by going down again as a consequence of what you've done. You take $1,000 from every family's $50,000 that it earned, an extra $1,000 in payroll tax, that's going to squeeze their capacity to make their mortgage payments. And I won't even go in to what a squeezed family budget by all these measures will do for the college students, who are now an entire generation, unlike any we have had in American history before. young people being told their only chance for a job is to have a college degree or often even a graduate degree beyond that, without being able to pay for it unless they go into deep debt. So in desperation, they and their parents are taking on the debt, only to discover that because of our austerity program, the job prospects are poor, and even if you get a job, the level of income you're likely to be paid, given the debts you've accrued, puts you in an impossible financial position for the rest of your life, means that you have to postpone or forget about higher education, you have to postpone or forget about having children. I mean, you are imposing on the basic life conditions of the mass of the American working class, step by step, whether the payroll tax in January, the sequester in March, or the Social Security cuts announced today in April, this is an assault, a continuing assault on the middle and lower classes, directly contradicting what both parties and both candidates for president promised they were committed to.
All right, Professor Wolf, again, remind us how people can most closely track your work.
The easiest thing to do is to go to my website, rdwolf2fs.com. Everything I do, including the analysis of Social Security and so on, is available free to anyone who wants it at that website. And the second one is what you can do about all of this, democracyatwork.info.
Beautiful. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints again.
Thank you, Dennis, and I hope you can send me that little link.
Right to you. Thanks so much. Bye-bye now. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Water fluoridation is the practice of adding industrial-grade fluoride chemicals to water for the purpose of preventing tooth decay. One of the little-known facts about this practice is that the United States, which fluoridates over 70% of its water supplies, has more people drinking fluoridated water than the rest of the world combined. Most developed nations, including all of Japan and 97% of Western Europe, do not fluoridate their water. In recent years, communities throughout the United States and Canada have started to reassess the conventional wisdom of fluoridating their water. Many of these communities are reaching the obvious conclusion. When stripped of its endorsements, well-meaning intentions, and PR praise, fluoridation simply makes no sense. Joining us to talk about this issue that impacts on many, many of us is somebody who I said knows a great deal about it. It's Dr. Paul Connett. He is a scientist specializing in environmental chemistry, toxicology, and waste management. He is the director of the Fluoride Action Network, and he has been on this topic for many years. Dr. Connett, it is really good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Dennis. I'm delighted to be with you, especially coming out of Berkeley. Berkeley is renowned for doing things first in this country, and
all right,
hopefully you'll be the first community in California to stop fluoridation.
Well, we're proud to have you with us, and let's come into it this way. Oral Health Division of the Center for Disease Control, that's the CDC, has really hailed fluoridation as one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. And I guess you might say that fluoridation is an outdated form of mass medication. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, when you talk about the Center of Disease Control, I'm glad you qualified it, because it isn't the whole body of 20,000 scientists down there. It is the small oral health division, which is only about 30 people, and they're all dentally trained. There's not a toxicologist amongst them. So they know very little about anything in the body except teeth. But to go to your question, this practice should never have started. We should never use the public water supply to deliver medicine, especially this one. There's not a single process in the body that needs fluoride, number one. Number two, we know that the first opponents of fluoridation were, in fact, biochemists who had used fluoride to poison enzymes in their experiments. But by using the public water to deliver a medicine, A, you can't control the dose, because you can't control how much water people drink, and it's ridiculous to give a drug to people when you can't control the dose. Secondly, you can't control who it goes to. It goes to everybody. It goes to babies. It goes to children. It goes to elderly people. It goes to sick people. It goes to people with poor nutrition. It goes to people with poor kidney function who are unable to get rid of all the fluoride that the normal person can get rid of. And it goes to people with borderline iodine deficiency who certainly shouldn't get any fluoride. So, and the third thing, of course, and every doctor should know this, that it violates the individual's right to informed consent to medication. And so what is happening in all the communities which are fluoridating in the United States and the handful of other countries is that the community is doing to everyone what an individual doctor can do to no one. An individual doctor cannot force you to take a medicine. They are required to tell you what the side effects are, what the benefits are, and you, in theory at least, are meant to decide whether you're going to take it or not. But in this case, with fluoridation, once you put a medicine in the water, any medicine, but in this case fluoride, you take that right away from individuals. And rightly, people are very angry about that when they find out what is happening.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're devoting a good chunk of today's show to talking about fluoridation. Well, let's backtrack a little bit. Give us a little bit of the history of this use of fluoridation and say something about, a little bit more about what the claims are, how it has impacted in a positive way on tooth decay, and what we know about the statistics around that.
The history is very murky, to say the least. It began with a series of trials in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Newburgh, New York, Evanston, Illinois, and a community in Canada, Brantford, Ontario, in the 1945. And then something peculiar happened. The United States Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation before any of those trials had been completed and before any significant health studies had been done or published. And that was in 1950. So obviously something political was operating in those days. And I guess there are two claims for what the politics were. One claim is the sugar industry was very interested in fluoridation. The